Good morning, this is Carla Dedesi with your Family Matters here at 1180 WFYL, working for your liberty. This morning, I have Deb Wright with me in the studio. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Deb has been working with the sex trafficking in Pennsylvania for the last 5 years.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, raising awareness about this issue.
Okay, awesome. Which awareness needs to be raised because I'll tell you, before I started my show here, I was in the dark that sex trafficking was happening in Pennsylvania, right here in the Lehigh Valley, Philadelphia,
yes.
Atlantic City is New Jersey. I thought it was something that only happened in Haiti, third world countries, and I thought maybe if it happens in the United States of America, it's places like Las Vegas.
Correct.
Or Manhattan, New York City. So I am thrilled that you're here. You're going to educate our families on all of the exciting things that you're doing to protect families and these little girls and these little boys. So why don't you share with us, how did you get involved with this calling?
This whole issue. You know, like so many people, I thought that if trafficking was happening, it was happening in other countries. I had watched, you know, a couple of, let's say, Dateline, 60-minute type stories, right, about this issue, and it was breaking my heart, but I felt very disconnected from it. I really couldn't relate to what was happening in other countries. I really didn't feel that there was anything I could do other than pray, which I had started doing, about this issue until one night the FBI raided my neighbor's house and I was home when it happened. And I went outside with one of my friends. We watched, you know, just something out of like a television show. The FBI agents in his house with flashlights and the jackets and the SUVs out in front. And we thought that it was drugs because we would never imagine, you know, what actually was going on. It was a man who was living with his parents who also had custody of his young son who was 8-year-old at the time. And we tried to find out what was going on, and the police would not tell us anything. And the most that one of my neighbors got out of the policeman that she was talking to was that if she didn't have children, then she had nothing to worry about. And then that raised a whole other level of alarm in my neighborhood. But we still couldn't find out any information until it broke in the news. It ended up being on the front page of the newspaper in the county where I live. And basically, it described that the FBI had found thousands and thousands and thousands of pornographic images on his computer, many of which were of young children and even of a baby. And then all of a sudden, this idea of children being enslaved for American consumption went from being something that potentially, you know, an issue of sex trafficking and slavery that happens in other countries to literally in my backyard, two houses away from me. So that really was a punch in the gut that I needed to get involved. And so I just felt like, to be honest with you, that God was saying it's time to get off your knees and to really use your hands, your mouth, your feet to do something about this. So I started doing research about this issue, about organizations to get involved with. I started getting involved with International Justice Mission, became a justice advocate for them, went around for about 4 years speaking at different events, representing them at different events to raise awareness, but yet still did not know how epidemic it was in Pennsylvania. So about 4 years into this, I ended up on a radio show, and the radio host said to me, well, how epidemic is this in Pennsylvania? And he said, I don't know, you know. And he said, well, can you help me put together another show? So I started making phone calls and doing research, and much to my shock and disgust, I realized that it is in every county, that there are certain task forces that have been set up to deal with it because of its prevalence in every county. It is growing. The laws were not in place to address this. And that the level of public ignorance was helping to fuel this. And that's when there was a sharp change in what I was doing from going from being someone who just spoke about this in my free time, to then moving into leaving my job to produce a documentary about the industry of sex trafficking in Pennsylvania.
So you left your job.
Yes.
To produce From Liberty to Captivity.
Correct.
Which is, tell us a little bit about that project.
So, you know, I was a journalism major starting out in college. My mom had actually produced a documentary back in the 70s before, you know, there were indie film festivals and before, you know, the documentaries were as sort of popular as they are now. And I watched her make a difference in an issue that she cared about, which was sort of the neglected elderly in Chicago. And I saw how the medium of film actually made a difference and an impact. And what came out of that was actually a non-for-profit that's been helping elderly ever since then. She's not a part of that, or she wasn't a part of it. But the film really helped to raise awareness and to create, you know, to make a difference. And so having experienced that, I decided, you know, really, I have to say not I decided, God really put it upon my heart to produce a film, because film has the power to really move people's hearts. We can give all the statistics that we, you know, to tell people what's going on, but really until you touch their hearts, until it becomes relatable to them, until they understand how it could potentially impact their families, or in some way it really opens their eyes to something that they care about, begin to care about, it's hard for people to really get involved and get invested in an issue. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of a film was, you know, to help people, bring people into this world and help them understand really what's going on in Pennsylvania and sex trafficking, but more importantly, to give people hope that something can be done about it. Because what's the point of really opening people's eyes if really there's nothing that they can do? So the storyline of the film is really interviewing people and telling stories of people who are on the front lines experiencing this on a day-to-day basis, like Department of Homeland Security personnel, FBI, detectives, people who are working with victims, survivor stories, and what this experience has been like for them, and really sort of profiling that from every perspective so people really understand comprehensively what's going on. But if we feel that the only people who can really make a difference with these issues are, let's say, lawmakers or, you know, police personnel, then we really don't feel like there's much that we can do. And other than supporting them, which we should do, we would feel that there's, you know, there's not much that we can do to impact this issue. So I want to say the most powerful part of this film is really profiling everyday citizens who are making a difference and stepping out into this issue and doing remarkable things, these everyday heroes that this issue has created.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think back to the Underground Railroad time, you think back to the American Revolution, you think back to different periods in our history, and honestly, fighting for liberty on behalf of others is truly a unique American ideal. You don't see it necessarily in countries around the world. It's an American ideal. So here you have Pennsylvania with a rich history of everyday citizens who really took that American ideal and put it in action and fought on behalf of other people throughout history to help bring freedom, you know, either for America and its foundation or for other people in the underground slavery time. Well, here we have also a period of history where you have people who are stepping up and who are really fighting on behalf of these people who have been enslaved, these victims who have been enslaved in sex trafficking, and they're doing remarkable things to do that. So really the question becomes, and we hope the audience will walk away with this, if they can do this and if they can change history, why can't I? And hopefully that will give them hope to see that they can make a difference by getting involved as well and literally change the course of history. We don't have African slavery the way that we did, right, back in the 1800s, because the Quakers and other people stepped up, who a large percentage of them went unnoticed throughout American history, right? We don't know the names of so many of these people. People have the capacity to change history, and this is an issue that is so critical and it is so needed, and yet people can have such a profound impact. And that is really the story of the film.
Okay, so let's talk about the film a little bit. So you shared that Homeland Security and you have victim survivors that mm-hmm. you are interviewing. I would assume that it might have been difficult for you to get victims who are now survivors. Perhaps they're embarrassed or perhaps they want anonymity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the good news is that what's happened with this issue is that there are organizations that are coming behind and supporting victim survivors.
Counseling them,
aftercare homes. Well, you know, there's not the specialized type of counseling or aftercare, comprehensive aftercare homes and sort of systems, if you will, to help bring these survivors into a place where they are healed and are standing up on their own feet and are able to, you know, make choices in their life, you know, to for a job or whatever.
So there's really not like a safe haven for these people.
Yeah.
That could be another ministry, actually, I'm sitting here thinking, because we have homeless shelters for men. We have
right.
homeless shelter for women and children. We have post-abortion counseling.
Yes.
But probably no one majors in post sex trafficking counseling.
Yeah, it's where our education system is falling behind. It's where funding is falling behind. It's where the lack of the public support, because they don't know about this issue, and they also don't understand the specialized type of counseling that would be needed and the long-term, comprehensive, complex support that victim survivors need. Take, for example, the average age of entry into, and now it's, you know, trafficking, people call it prostitution, but if someone's a minor, it's trafficking, is around 14, 15 years old. So what are the chances that someone, if they end up, being able to escape that situation or being, you know, they get help to get out of that situation, what are the chances that that person has finished their high school education? What's happening with them health-wise after years and years of abuse? Psychological, physical, sexual abuse, you know, what skills do they have, you know? So if you look at, you know, a victim as they come out of that situation, they need for people to come alongside them and really help and really specialize towards what their needs are and to have the resources to be able to help them in every area that is needed. So we don't have the type of support that, honestly, some third world countries are starting to have for victim, you know, survivors. In the United States, we're really lagging behind because I think there's a misconception that as long as you move someone out of that situation, then they're okay. They can sort of make their way in life, but they need a lot of support. They don't need for us to take over their lives, but they need support in areas where they don't have the resources or the expertise to be able to help themselves. And so we don't have the prevalence of that in the United States the way that we need to. In Pennsylvania, we certainly don't have that. But I will say that there are several people, several organizations that are working to open up aftercare homes. There's one in Lancaster, one in Lehigh Valley, one in Bucks County. So there are people who are working to do this, but there still is a lot more work that needs to happen. So There are organizations that are trying to help victim survivors. They are a support system and mentorship, provide mentorship for victim survivors. So I think versus 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there's more help, there's more support than there was. And so there, you know, we have been able to get in contact with some victim survivors who are willing to share their stories. Who are recognizing the impact that their story can have not only on their own healing, but also on, you know, helping other people understand what this issue is all about and what we need to do to address it, both fighting it on the demand side, fighting it on the legal side in terms of laws that should be in place, and also how to adequately support victim survivors without their voice. We don't know what to do to help equip them to be successful and to move on with their lives. And so there are people who are really courageously standing up. And it's not it's not important for every victim survivor to do that. Every person has their own path, and for some of them, the pathway may be, and they may feel it's really important for them to share their story to help raise awareness. So we do have some victim survivors that we've been really blessed who really support the film and want to, you know, to have the film share their stories.
This is Carla Dedesi with Your Family Matters here in the studio with Deb Wright. She's a speaker to International Justice Mission. She is also the producer of From Liberty to Captivity. She has been championing for the victims of sex trafficking for the last 5 years, and she is here sharing her vision and her goals in this area, talking about, again, From Liberty to Captivity. What has been your biggest challenge with producing this documentary? You share that this is the first time you're producing a documentary, although your mother did a successful one in the 70s. So what has been your biggest challenge?
Finances. It is a very difficult topic. I mean, I've had people who, you know, have been very honest with me about their discomfort about this topic, especially if they're parents of young girls. Because they already recognize that it's a hard world to raise children in. And I had one parent, and I really appreciated what she said to me. She said, you know, I really want to learn more about this, but I'm afraid that I will become so afraid of my children being in this world that, you know, I would almost take away their freedoms because I'd be looking at every single person. Is this a trafficker? Is this a pedophile? Is this someone who's dangerous to my child? So there is that fear of if you know something, you're, you know, more likely to experience it, or it'll change your worldview, and it'll, you know, it'll take away the preciousness of your children having a level of innocence, right? Or that this, you know, that this couldn't potentially happen to my child. You know, I live in an upscale suburb, you know, outside of Philadelphia, or even, you know, my kids go to private schools in Philadelphia or whatever. So this probably happens maybe in the inner city, or it happens in heavy crime-ridden areas where there's, you know, low-income housing type of thing. But what people aren't realizing is that the traffickers are aware of the fact that there are segments of the population who do not know about this, and they are going after the children in these suburbs. For example, the King of Prussia Mall has been known to be a, you know, hot spot for traffickers to go and to meet, you know, young girls who are unattended. Let's say their parents are not with them, that are there in groups, where they will try to develop a relationship with, you know, one of the girls, let's say, for example, to ultimately traffic them. So there are areas, Lancaster, Lehigh Valley, Bucks County, where I'm from, Chester County, Delaware County, every single county in the state, regardless of the socioeconomic situation of that county, has a level of trafficking going on. And I remember talking to a federal prosecutor who's been working very hard in Pennsylvania to bring justice to these cases and awareness, told me to her surprise about 30% of her cases are of the quote-unquote child next door, of that child that you would think would not be a potential victim. So in trying to raise money to do this film, it's a very difficult topic. Filmmaking in general, independent documentary filmmaking, is very difficult. If I was doing a film about a hero story of people who fought against breast cancer, it would be really easy for me to raise money because it's an area that has affected many people. Mm-hmm. It doesn't touch a level of evil that mm-hmm. this does. And it doesn't hit us in places that this issue of sex trafficking does. And so it's been just really difficult to raise funds to try to move this forward, but, you know, it needs to be done.
And so where are you pursuing fundraising? Is there grant money that you're trying to tap into? Are there churches whom you're going to?
Yeah. So it's interesting because most independent documentaries are produced through funds that are given by everyday people who care about whatever the topic is. It's interesting because you would think that most documentaries are made by big studios that have a lot of money or, you know, organizations that give big grants. But a majority of documentaries, it's the people who write a check for $50, for $25, for $100 that help to make a documentary come to life. And that was something that surprised me when I got into this and I started doing research on what were the best ways to raise money for this. So we have actually had a series of fundraising events where we've also brought people from that particular county or area to speak about the issue so people could get involved right away during the event and get connected to an organization once they learn more about this issue. So we've been doing a series of events like this. There have been several churches that have backed us up as well. Individual people who hear about this through, radio mm-hmm. programs like this one, thank you so much, or, you know, different people who have volunteered who are spreading the word. We've gotten a lot of individual contributions that way. Certainly there are grants that are out there, but you can imagine that it's very competitive. It's a very complex process to get a grant. So that wouldn't probably be where we'd get a majority of the funding. So we're really thinking that the funding will come from individual people who want to be a part of something larger than themselves and raising awareness and believe in the concept of a film around this, mm-hmm. As well as organizations who are made up of people who would care about this issue.
Let me ask you this question. Do you have a website or Facebook, Twitter? I know that it's very trendy right now to raise money on your website with funds like Indiegogo
right.
or GoFund, I think is another one. Is that something that you're doing?
Yes.
That you can share with people who are listening, that they can go to your website and put something?
So we do have a website. It's www.fromlibertytocaptivity.com, and there is a tab that you can click on that says donate, and then you can, you know, go follow the instructions to give a tax deductible donation. We do have a Facebook site, and it is, again, From Liberty to Captivity. What we are trying to do is raise enough money to create a trailer for the film so people can get a glimpse into the power of this film, and then once we are able to put this trailer together, we want to put it on either Kickstarter or Indiegogo to continue to raise funds to complete the film. So we are definitely using social media and the different venues that people have been using to raise money to produce independent films like this. And we need about $15,000 to produce the trailer. We have a film crew that has been working on social issues. Actually, they've been out in Africa in June and July. They're in Canada. And they're a fantastic, actually, couple that we're working with. The wife is a professor of cinematography for a university here in Pennsylvania. And so we really only need about $15,000 to finish up the trailer and then get the trailer out, and then obviously footage from the trailer would be used in the film itself. I also have some musicians. This is an exciting part of what we're doing, too. You know, not only is film powerful, but so is music. So every event, we've always had local musicians that have come and have performed who really care about this issue. So then the decision was made to produce a CD with original songs that people would write who really care about this issue. And so I do have a musician that we're partnering with who has a large international and national following who really thinks, really cares about this issue, really believes in this film and this project. And so he's going to help us really get the word out when we get the trailer done and help promote us on social media as well. And write the score for the film and the actual trailer and also write some original music and really partner with us musically to help reach people through their hearts in a musical way, right? Just like the film will in another way. So we're very excited about that as well.
So, again, it really sounds like God is bringing all of these people together.
Yes.
Probably he has been laying things on your hearts over the last 5 to 10 years. Nobody really knew what was happening,
exactly.
But God did. He's brought you all together. You're all producing this and just helping in any way that you can. From Liberty to Captivity, is it primarily all about Pennsylvania trafficking, It is.
Yes.
Okay, so it's not national. Of course, we can relate this, I'm sure, to every other state, but
right.
maybe this will even be something that you'll research in New Jersey or
yes,
in Las Vegas.
We have.
I mean, I don't know what's down the line.
Well, the reason why, really, I would have to say it wasn't my vision for the film. It was really God's heart for this film. And I remember praying about this because when it was first put on my heart, I remember thinking to myself, I mean, listen, I live in Pennsylvania. I love Pennsylvania. But who really would be interested in seeing a film about trafficking in Pennsylvania? And really what I felt God was saying to me was, you know, he had a very specific vision for the United States and for America. And Pennsylvania, in many ways, is kind of holy ground for that. This is really the birthplace of freedom for America. So by taking a look comprehensively at what's happening in Pennsylvania and seeing what's happening and the fall of Pennsylvania really represents the fall of America in many ways in this area. And so although it really focuses on stories of Pennsylvania, the truth of the matter is there are suburbs all around the United States that are similar to the suburbs of Pennsylvania. There are families with similar situations in Pennsylvania as those throughout the United States. We have, you know, Philadelphia, which is a major city, which has a similar situation to other cities in the United States. So while we are really going to dig deep into what's happening in Pennsylvania, it really is relatable to many other states in the United States. And in fact, on Facebook, we have a lot of our Facebook followers are not from Pennsylvania, but they are rallying behind this because they feel an affinity for what Pennsylvania stands for you know, liberty, for freedom. And so if we are captive in this area, then so are the other states, and I think other people can relate to this film.
Awesome. Let me ask you this question. Hopefully we will produce a chain reaction right here in Pennsylvania for the other states. But tell me a little bit about International Justice Mission.
So International Justice Mission is just absolutely a fantastic organization that has really had an impact on many countries around the world and legislation and really helping churches in the United States come alongside this issue and really support the work that's being done all around the world. Gary Haugen is the founder and head of International Justice Mission. He worked for the Department of Justice years ago. He was assigned to head up the Rwanda genocide investigation. And as he was working on that investigation and doing some other work internationally, he really became aware of this issue of slavery and human trafficking. And through a lot of prayer and a lot of discussions with his family and other people, decided to leave his job with the Department of Justice. And this is a guy who went to Harvard and University of Chicago, who really could be rolling in millions of dollars because he's just so brilliant as a lawyer, and decided to walk away from all that because he felt this issue was so important and God had just placed such a burden on his heart. So he started International Justice Mission. They've been around for about 15 years. What I love about what this organization does is they look to work inside a country's own infrastructure to change that infrastructure to the extent that there's sustainable change. You know, it's one thing for American organizations to swoop into another country and to have a fast fix and then to say, leave that situation, and then everything kind of falls apart again. Because of Gary's legal knowledge and because he has such great business savvy, and he also has a lot of wisdom, I believe, that he's developed, you know, he has from his relationship with the Lord, they go in and they work to train police forces, they work to train judges, they work to change laws from the inside with citizens who are from those countries and understand the culture and the country itself to make changes in those countries that are sustainable in this area. And it's remarkable what God's been doing, because in situations where they go in, we have a corrupt police force, untrained people, judges who aren't familiar with, you know, with these types of cases, a culture that goes against it. I mean, they've got all kinds of barriers in certain countries, yet God has multiplied their efforts and blessed what they've done to the extent where there's been remarkable things happening. And just to give you one example, in Cebu, and I hope I'm saying it right, in the Philippines, there was a high prevalence of minorities that were available for sex trafficking. And IJM was given a grant by the Bill Gates Foundation to really study how sustainable this change was in terms of working within the infrastructure, training, teaching detectives and police forces on the correct forensic investigations. I mean, even just doing an examination to understand what happened to someone who's been victimized, a lot of people don't have that ability, doctors, nurses, you know, police, whatever. So they went in and they studied them for 5 years, and IJM really felt that it would be, sort of considered a success if there had been about a 20% reduction in the availability of minors. What ended up happening after the 5 years is that they found that there was a 79% reduction.
Awesome.
Yes. I look at that, and the reason why I share that example is because here you have a country that does not have the sophisticated justice system that we have. They don't have the legal system that we have. They don't have the financial resources that we have. And yet, when you mobilize and educate people and train people and really come together to change things, you can have a tremendous impact. So if they can do that over there, what can we do here? And this is why awareness is so important.
I agree with you 100%, Deb. Share with me some of your statistics.
Yeah.
And then I want to ask you some questions.
Okay. So, you know, I think, I go back to, statistics will help to help people understand what the magnitude is. But I think people need to also understand that whether it is one person or it's 30 million people, as long as anyone's enslaved, I just feel that God calls us to step up on behalf of the oppressed. But just to give you some statistics around the reality of slavery, a statistic that was sort of thrown around the last few years was that 27 million people are enslaved around the world. That has actually gone up to around 30 million. And so you can see that there's an urgency for us to address this because it is increasing. One of the reasons why it's increasing is, for example, there is a switch from the business of, let's say, selling drugs to trafficking people. And the reason for that is because if you sell a drug, you sell it once, and then, you know, you just whatever profit you make. But if you have a person and you can sell them over and over and over again, you have sort of sustainable income, and it's highly profitable. We also have pretty strict laws. Even though we really are struggling with the influx of drugs in the United States especially, we do have the DEA. We do have laws to address this. But in terms of human trafficking, especially sex trafficking, the United States, and especially on a state-by-state level, has really lagged behind. So just from a purely economic perspective, if you're going to go into a business without regard for, you know, life or without regard for morality, it is highly profitable. There aren't a lot of laws that will hold you back from it. It's, you know, the public is not aware of it like they are with the heroin epidemic that we've been hearing about in Pennsylvania, right? That's been on the news all the time. People are not aware of this. So this is why it's flourishing the way it is and why we need to really step up and address this. Now, human trafficking can be labor trafficking, it can be sex trafficking, but for a large percentage, about 80% of the trafficking cases involve the sex industry, commercial sexual exploitation. Over half of the victims are women and girls. 50% of slaves are under the age of 18. You think about that. Human trafficking in the U.S. is almost a $10 billion industry. Worldwide, it's estimated to be about $32 billion. So if you think about population in the United States relative to the rest of the world, and you think about that we are about a third of the dollar volume of this, of the revenues of this, and you think about what percentage of the population of human beings is in the United States versus the rest of the world, it's mind-blowing to think about how much of the American dollar is going towards this. So that's a statistic that just absolutely blows me away. Human trafficking would be ranked number 97 if it was listed in Forbes Fortune 500. And the average age of entry of people being in prostituted or trafficked, if they're minors, is 12 to 14. And estimates range that there's between 100,000 and 250,000 children at risk of being trafficked in the U.S., and at least 100,000 children are exploited, are being trafficked every year in America. 10% of U.S. children living in shelters and about 28% of children living on streets report exchanging sex for drugs and money, which is trafficking, right? So if you're in a situation, what I really love about the definition of trafficking is the use of force, fraud, coercion to enslave another person for profit. And so it doesn't mean that it necessarily someone has to get beat up or they have to be kidnapped, you know, in order for them to be considered a trafficking victim. There could be a situation like with a runaway who is in desperate need of shelter, of food, you know, has no way of providing for themselves. And someone can come in and through that situation end up, you know, trafficking that person. So the federal definition, which now we have finally adopted in Pennsylvania, is really important because the whole core of trafficking is taking advantage of an opportunity that arises through vulnerability. And so that vulnerability doesn't always have to be, you know, physically taking force over another person to traffic them. It could be psychological manipulation, which in many cases it is, where they end up trafficking someone through a relationship that's developed, like a boyfriend relationship, through sort of a power difference where you have someone who is a child who's run away and runs into an adult who pretends to care for them or want to take care of them. So there are many different ways that traffickers and their level of sophistication, and people don't understand the level of sophistication that traffickers have, make a way to find victims and to get these victims to traffic. And so, you know, the other thing that I want to share with you is that it's estimated that 50,000 people at any time are trading in illegal images of children. And I bring that up because that's what got me involved in this issue to begin with. Now, if those images are not sold, it's not considered commercial sexual exploitation. But nonetheless, there are strict laws against this. But pornography is playing a big part in this in terms of fueling the demand. There's lots of research that shows that the addiction to pornography is as strong as it is to other drugs or to drugs in general, and that there is a strong link between viewing pornography and then acting upon that pornography, especially as it pertains to child pornography. So where the internet is making available and making it anonymous for you to be able to obtain these images and some gratification from these images, the likelihood of you watching these images and then acting upon it is very high. So that is fueling the demand for our children to be exploited.
Correct. And Deb, I think that was it 10 or 15 years ago that our Supreme Court stated that, you know, virtual child pornography was legal. Am I correct in that? Virtual, if it's virtual. Or do you not know anything about
that? I don't know about that.
Because they felt like it wasn't reality. If you don't know anything about
that. So when you're saying virtual,
can't you do things on the internet that it's not a real child that's doing these acts?
Yeah.
But it's just a virtual, you know, pornographic scene of children or an adult with a child.
So like a comic strip type of a thing.
Right.
Would be, I don't know about that. I don't know. I'd have to look into that and take a look at that.
If that indeed is so, then that is absolutely linked to why this is being fueled and why people are even, you know, receptive or have a desire to do this with a 10-year-old, 12-year-old that should still be, you know, roller skating or playing tennis, you know, but not, we shouldn't be looking at these 14-year-olds as these sexual objects, these lustful sexual objects.
Right. And here's the thing one of the things that really shocked me when I started doing research for the film. There is a woman from the University of Pennsylvania that we want to include in the film who is really an expert in this area of pornography. And one of the things that she shared with me that she found through her research is that, you know, we seem to compartmentalize people who would watch child pornography as people who are naturally pedophiles. What she was sharing with me is that research is now showing that as someone becomes addicted to pornography, there's kind of an escalation like with drugs, okay? So you could have a husband and a father who is not a pedophile, who is not who does not it would sicken him to think about someone watching child pornography or being engaged in sexual activity with a child. And over time, as he watches pornography and this addiction's being fueled and his brain and his body chemicals, you know, like a drug, need to have a different level of pornography in order to sort of continue to feed that
need. Level of stimulation.
Exactly. That oftentimes it will go into more violent types of pornography. So you're seeing that there's pornography out there that is extremely violent now with, you know, women and men or whatever else. But if that need continues to happen and increases in them, they may also switch over into child pornography. So you can have a person who is a kind of a regular person who does not have, you know, an interest or desire in any way to engage in that activity with children when they first start out. But because of what happens in, you know, in the chemistry of the brain relative to this, ends up becoming someone who watches child pornography. And that's the thing that really shocked me when she was explaining this to me, because that helps to fuel the demand for children to be trafficked. And think about what that does to a person who thought that they were sort of initially watching pornography. We say it's harmless, you know, it just, and then they end up getting caught up into some level of addiction that leads them to do things that they never would have imagined that they would do.
Deb, it's the law of diminishing returns. Do you
exactly.
know what that means?
Exactly.
Yes. So, you know, you hold the hand with your boyfriend, it's so exciting and fabulous. But then that gets a little dulled.
Yes.
And then you go a little bit further and that gets a little dulled. So we should always be protecting ourselves. We don't want to try and get away with as much as we can.
Right.
We want to try and stay as pure as we possibly can.
Right.
Noble thoughts, righteous
right.
thoughts.
So
I absolutely believe and agree with you that for those people that are entrenched in adult pornography and they think, oh, it's really not that bad, well, that gets boring, and now they're looking for another stimulant or
right.
something that's a greater, more fabulous release.
Right.
So I just want to thank you so much for educating us, and if you could leave us with your website or your Facebook, where you are at Facebook or Twitter, and how we can follow you or donate to your cause, that would be amazing.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I have to be honest with you, Carla. It has been difficult enough to raise funds that we are trying to figure out if we can continue to move forward with this, which is just breaking my heart.
How much more money do you need? You said you needed
$15,000. For the trailer, $15,000.
Okay.
We are confident that when people actually watch a trailer like you do when you see movie previews.
On YouTube
right,
or something.
Exactly. That we will, once people get a glimpse of what's happening, that they will be that we'll be able to raise funds to finish a film. And we're ready to go. We have everything in place. We've done all the pre-screening. It's just a matter of financial support. So if the listeners have been moved by this conversation and would like to, first of all, if they love film and they'd like to be a part of something like this project, that would be fantastic if they would support independent filmmakers doing films about issues that we really should be aware of. But secondly, if they have children, you know, and want to be a part of doing something to raise awareness to protect their own children, or just care about this issue because it's the right thing to do, we would just so appreciate their support. So you can go to www.fromlibertytocaptivity.com, click on the donate button, and there you can get our address to send a tax-deductible check to, or you can actually donate online as well. Again, tax-deductible. And we also do have a Facebook site. Please visit our Facebook site, because we do have not only information to help educate people on this issue, but we also oftentimes put information about local organizations all over Pennsylvania that are hosting events, ways people can get involved. So it really is one-stop shopping for, you know, for lack of a better word, around this issue, especially if you live in the Pennsylvania area. And our Facebook site is the same as the film, From Liberty to Captivity. And we also have a Twitter account at FromLib, L-I-B, to Cap, C-A-P. And so please, you know, get connected with us. We have just so appreciated the support that we've gotten. And just thank you so much for listening to this issue.
Thank you for joining us today. This was Your Family Matters with Carla Dedessi. We thank Deb Wright for all she's doing with her documentary From Liberty to Captivity. Also all that she's doing with International Justice Mission to get the word out about sex trafficking right here in Pennsylvania.
Don't peek, young man. We keeping it virtuous, baby.
Dressing modest, we know it's rough. When the world is making it so tough, don't need short shirts or low-cut shirts. Being the way that you are is enough.
That's right, baby.
Everyone else doesn't seem to care.
Yeah.
Everyone else but you. Baby, you light up the world like nobody else. By the way that you speak and respect yourself. Girls with integrity are hard to find these days. You gotta know. Oh, oh. You are so beautiful. If only you saw what I can see. You'd understand why I need your modesty. Right now I'm talking to you and you must believe. You gotta know. Oh, oh. Virtue is so beautiful. Oh, oh, oh. That's what makes you beautiful.
Don't be young man. Only thinking of girls is virtuous, baby.
So come on, must have it wrong. To prove we're right, we put it in a song.
Yeah.
We don't know what you want a guy.
Woo.
That only cares what he sees with his eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone else doesn't seem to care. Everyone else but you. Maybe you light up the world like nobody else. By the way that you speak and respect yourself. Girls with integrity are hard to find these days. You gotta know. Oh, oh. You are so beautiful. If only you saw what I can see. You'd understand why I need your modesty. Right now I'm looking at you and you must believe. You gotta know, oh, virtue is so beautiful, oh, that's what makes you beautiful. By the way that you speak and respect yourself. Girls with integrity are hard to find these days. You gotta know. Oh, oh. You are so beautiful.
You gotta know. You gotta know. You gotta know. Yeah, baby.
This is Carla Dedessi with Your Family Matters here every Friday from 8 until 9 Eastern Standard Time. Please stream in or listen on your radio at 1180 WFYL, working for your liberty. We just listened to a song, Virtue Makes You Beautiful. My little girls and I have been singing this song in our house. The lyrics are truly beautiful, and it is about modesty. And this is kind of a dirty word these days, I think, modesty. It's not something that I think our society prizes or upholds. And as a mom of three little girls, and I have a lot of nieces, and just as a woman, you know, I think that in my younger years, I dressed immodestly. And I didn't really have an idea about how my dress affected others who were looking at me or watching me or taking me seriously. But in reality, you know, women, our cleavage does not make us beautiful. Our tight skirts does not make us beautiful. Short skirts do not make us beautiful. Having integrity and virtue and having morals, that is what makes all human beings, not just women, but even men, beautiful. So I want to share with you today a couple of things that we do in our house just to promote modesty. Number one, as a mom, I try to model what modesty looks like for my children. And listen, you have to talk to your husband, or if you don't have a husband, you just have to talk, you know, and identify what you think is modest. But obviously, you know, I dress conservatively. That doesn't mean that I have turtlenecks on all the time and I don't wear skirts that are all the way down to my ankles. And certainly that is what some people may think is modesty. They want to be completely covered up. But I think that there's a lot of trendy fashions out there, you know, whether it's Lily Pulitzer or Ralph Lauren. You know, we can be trendy and still be modest. So the girls know that I don't like to wear tops that are too tight. If I have skirts that are on the tighter side, I usually have a big oversized shirt. I wear tights with my Uggs, but I have a big, huge, oversized shirt that comes over and covers my tush. So obviously my girls will dress that same way. I tend to be a mommy that like one-piece bathing suits. We do one-piece bathing suits or tankinis in our house. You know, I think that they're modest, but I also think that when I'm throwing the kids in the pool or we're riding the waves together, I really don't have to be concerned, though sometimes you still have to be concerned, but a tankini or a one-piece, I don't have to be concerned as much that when I come up from that wave that something's going to be hanging out that I don't want hanging out. We're big on making sure that things are not see-through. You know, I'm not big on having, you know, my 13-year-old bra strap showing. That's just something that I think should be kept underneath of their clothing. And again, I'm just trying to teach my little girls that the way that we dress and the way that we present ourselves is going to have an effect on other people. And we do not live in a vacuum. So I remember we had someone come into church one time and talk about sexual purity. And what this speaker did is something that I thought was really very apropos. When we all walked in, the boys and the girls, and this is something that was done in youth group when I was in youth group, she had this whole entire table of decadent desserts, chocolate cakes, chocolate fountains, cheesecakes, tarts, all of this fabulous stuff. And when we walked in, she said, "You're not allowed to stare at that table. Don't look at it. You're not allowed to look. I don't want to see anybody peeking over there. You're not allowed to touch it. You're not allowed to eat it. Don't look at it." And of course, you can see where I'm going with this. Where I'm going is sometimes our girls who are 12, 13, 14, 24 years old, even some of my mommy friends, you know, we're dressing with things that are very tight on our chests and we have a lot of cleavage showing, or we have a very short skirt in that, you know, if the wind blows, oops, we're going to see everything. You know, you're basically saying, you know, you can look at this, but don't touch. Or maybe you're inviting people to touch. I don't know. But modesty is not just about protecting yourself, but it's also about protecting men from seeing you as something more than just a sex object, really, or something that they're going to lust after. And you know, moms and dads, today, every magazine cover, many shows, many billboards are not teaching modesty. So this is kind of a battle that we're in. So, you know, I just want to share with you that there are other families out there that are trying to teach our children modesty, and that really what makes our daughters and our little boys beautiful is being virtuous and having wonderful moral attributes. Again, this is Carla DeDessi, Your Family Matters, talking about modesty during this season of summer, when we have a lot of very thin and tiny clothes on because of the warm weather. Try to teach your children modesty first. Again, this is Carla DeDessi, Your Family Matters, here at 1180 WFYL.